Okay, thank you. Conservation Committee.
Wait.
we're not doing land and water.
Moving at the speed of cyberspace, in cyberspace.
Okay.
Conservation Committee, everybody see it?
Yeah.
We did land in first.
Item approval of previous meeting minutes.
We did land.
Motion.
Commissioner Bittner, second from Friedkin, all say aye.
Aye.
Got through that one? Committee item number one, Bob Cook, land and water plant update.
Thanks, sir.
What's up here today, Bob?
Couple of free items that I want you to know about in our conservation committee area. In October, we started out 25 new cadets in our 52nd Texas Game Warden Cadet Academy. And we are currently underway with plans for a capture campaign for the new Texas Game Warden Training Center up in Hamilton County. And you'll be hearing more about that in the next few months. Second item, our TPWD Forensic Laboratory has received national accreditation and is fully operational now. We completed the transfer of Bradley State Natural Area back to the Austin Community Foundation effective September 1 of 2006, and we successfully completed the transfer of the Lake Houston State Park to the City of Houston effective August 25, 2006. As of October 1, 2006, Coastal Fisheries staff began executing a four-year, $3.2 million hurricane disaster relief grant to restore damage to orchard beds and shrimp grounds caused by hurricanes Katrina and Rita. The grant will be used for three purposes: to map bottom habitats in Galveston Bay and Sabine Lake to establish a post-hurricane baseline. Second, to use the mapping information to prioritize which orchard beds to restore with available funds. And finally, remove debris from orchard beds and shrimp grounds caused by the hurricane. Yes,
sir. Okay. Any questions for Bob? All right. Item number two, sand and gravel program box meeting.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mr. Cook, I'm Bob Sweeney with the Legal Division, and with me today is Roland McCray of the Inland Fisheries Division, and we're here to brief you about Parks and Wildlife Department regulation of sand and gravel disturbance in navigable waters. And we're briefing you partly because this is an important program of the department, but partly because, as commissioners, you may come to be directly involved in one of these permitting matters down the road. It doesn't happen often, but it is possible. I'll tell you more about that as we go along. This is a program that has been in Texas law for a long time. 1911 is when the original statute regulating this matter was enacted. And the principle of the law is that folks who disturb or remove materials from navigable waters should compensate the state for the effects that they're causing on fish habitat. At one time, royalty payments were a very important source of department funding, particularly when oyster shell disturbance was an element of this program. Today, there is no commercial oyster shell removal anymore. Today, the program is found in Parks and Wildlife Code Chapter 86 and in 31 Texas Administrative Code Chapter 69. It's jointly managed by Legal, Inland Fisheries, and Law Enforcement Division. It applies to the beds of navigable waters between grading boundaries or below tidewater limits if it's saltwater. And we rely fairly heavily on the General Land Office Chief Surveyor for determinations relating to navigability and grading boundary when those are necessary to determine whether our jurisdiction is called into the matter. This slide summarizes what kinds of royalties we are receiving in recent years. I would say on average we receive between $400,000 and $500,000 a year in royalty payments. The royalty amount is 20 cents per ton or 8% of the selling price of the material that severs more. By law, those revenues must be deposited into Fund 9 and at least 3/4 of the proceeds must be used for fish hatcheries. Not all disturbances of sedimentary materials in navigable waters require a Parks and Wildlife Department permit. There are lots of exemptions. Disturbances authorized by General Land Office lease or easement, disturbances for navigational purposes, and the rest as you see on this list. Parks and Wildlife divides its permitting activities into two general categories, individual permits for large commercial disturbances over 1,000 cubic yards and general permits for disturbances of under 1,000 cubic yards. Sometimes we get applications for general permits where we believe that the sensitivity of the area to be disturbed requires deeper examination. Will require those to be considered as individual permits as the rules allow. This slide regarding individual permits goes through the requirements and the general characteristics of individual permits. This one deals with general permits. When we receive these applications, our staff reviews them for ecological factors and effects on navigation and hydrology. A lot of times, our jurisdiction overlaps with that of other agencies, depending on the nature of the project that's being undertaken. Sometimes that's the Army Corps of Engineers, sometimes that's FEMA when there are floodplain implications, sometimes that's TCEQ when there are water pollution implications or water rights implications for the projects that require the disturbance or removal of sedimentary material. All right. We talked about the possibility that permitting matters might at some point come before you as commissioners to decide. On all of these applications, general or individual, there is a possibility that an interested person, including the applicant, could ask for a contested case hearing. This agency doesn't handle very many of those, but it is possible that this could arise. These are governed by the Administrative Procedure Act. If a matter goes to contested case hearing, it becomes a situation where, as commissioners, you will be sitting as judges, and therefore ex parte communications have to be avoided. In other words, if an interested party or the applicant were to contact you about the matter, that is something that you would appropriately refer to staff to deal with, to preserve your ability to decide the case on the basis of the record and the facts that are presented before you when you're sitting as judges. In the years that I've been here, which is now nearly seven, I have never seen one of these actually come before the commission, but we have started down that road on several occasions and have had to advise the commission that contacts of this nature had to be screened. If this were to occur, an administrative judge would make a recommendation, the Parks and Wildlife Commission, you would make a final decision as to whether the permit should be issued or not and what conditions it should contain, and your decision would be appealable to district court. Folks who don't comply with the law and regulations are subject to criminal prosecution. Generally, they are Class C misdemeanors. Also, there are some fairly powerful civil remedies that are available, penalties of up to $10,000 per day, plus restitution for the value of the materials taken or the resources damaged are the civil remedies that are available. And, Commissioner, that's all I have today. I'm available for any questions.
As far as refresh my memory, how do you make that determination on what is a navigable stream and what's not?
There are the most popular, the most commonly used test is in the Natural Resources Code, and that statute has been on the books for 170. Yeah, 1837. It's been in the law. It says that if it averages 30 feet in width from the mouth up, it is navigable. And it doesn't matter, according to the courts, whether it actually has water in it all the time. It can be dry much of the time. So there are two other tests that are less commonly used. One is whether the waterway is navigable in fact. It can be narrower than 30 feet, but if there's some indication it's been used in commerce or for recreation, historically that may be navigable in fact. And the third is if it's a perennial stream that was part of a Spanish or Mexican land grant prior to the creation of the Republic of Texas. Those stream beds are also owned by the state because the state took over those rights from the governments that it succeeded. But usually the 30-foot rule is what we end up applying.
Any questions? I noticed in 2004 there was a dramatic spike in the revenues. What did you attribute?
I believe that is because we audited an operation in 2004 and they've been underpaying. And so those numbers probably spiked that year because they paid all the back royalties when the permit was renewed at that time.
Okay, then it leveled off.
Then leveled off. Okay. I think that's right.
Yeah, the these permits that you issue, are they time sensitive? In other words, like for 2 weeks or a month or a year, or are they in perpetuity for a fixed term, or typically how, what's the length of time on the permit?
We are allowed by our regulations to issue a permit for no longer than 3 years. We sometimes issue them for shorter periods.
So I guess what I'm trying to determine is whether the revenues are flat because we have not been able to escalate the royalty on it, or is it just the nature of the beast, as you might say?
There are significant barriers to entry, and one of them is part of our regulations that would require an extensive study of the impact on erosion and the sand budget in the Gulf of Mexico if streams that have not historically been mined for sand and gravel were put into this program. Therefore, most of the operations are now on the Lower Brazos, and it would be difficult, if not impossible, for folks to permit other streams in this state for commercial purposes.
And who bears the cost of that?
And one final question. Are the royalties, if we were to go back for 8 years, for example, or 10 years, would the royalty amount be pretty much the same, or has it escalated with time?
I would say it would be pretty much the same. I think that number hasn't changed very much for.
And is that because of the market conditions, or I mean, have we thought of maybe escalating the royalty percentages? Or?
The last time the commission changed the price of the material was about 10 years ago, and it was in response to actually a challenge from the commissioner of the General Land Office, who said we were giving away state material, and that so. A study was done to see what the market price was, for instance, materials that are taken from private sources rather than ours, and also what the General Land Office was charging for sand off of the state land. And it settled back down to about that 20% or, I mean, 20 cents a ton or 8% of the price at the gate after it's gone over the scale.
Well, we've had it there for 10 years?
For 10 years. Yeah. It was originally set at 4 cents a ton 80 years ago or something like that.
And the reason I say that is because if you look at materials in the private sector, they keep escalating, and mm-hmm. we may be staying behind, as you mentioned.
The sale price for oyster shell escalates every 6 months based on the consumer price index, but that's never been done with sand or gravel. Right.
Every 6 months?
They review the consumer price index every 6 months, and as it's gone up.
Is that the information action?
Yeah.
It would require the governor's approval as well as I believe
the commission sets it, and then it goes to the governor's office for approval.
Right. That's how the royalty amount gets changed.
What is surprising to me is, irrespective of the fact that the royalties are down, that it's still flat. It would seem to me that if the royalties were down and the price was down, as compared to the private sector, you'd see a spike in it, but you're not seeing that. But if you're saying it because it's so hard to get the permit.
There are some barriers to entry, but what our operators tell us is that a lot more people who have been in this business historically have been put out of business by the river than by any aspect of regulation. And there's an enormous amount of removal, commercial removal of sand and gravel just back from a berm, you know, on the edge of a river, and that's where, you know, 99% of the material that is used in construction is I believe, you know, coming from, and much less that comes from within the river, from the state property.
All of our permittees to be in the river also have adjacent upland pits that they pull most of their material from, and so the river is sort of a target of opportunity, and local opposition, when those were all big ranches and nobody even knew they were there, now every time somebody comes in for a permit, there is opposition because increasingly it's the area southwest of Houston, and it's all subdivisions around them, and they think they're ugly and noisy, and they don't want them in their
neighborhood. We hear a lot about muddy water.
Yeah. And most of the Lower Brazos.
Would the commission
like for staff to look into this price issue and come back to you in a meeting or two with a recommendation or some feedback. We can go out to the public and find out what's going on and what we might do. Would that be your...
I think just do a side-by-side comparison with the oyster shell price and see, and obviously pointing out that there are other costs associated with being our lessee in excess of the royalty. There's the regulatory cost and the environmental compliance burden. Who carries the burden of the cost of the environmental study on the permit?
The applicant does.
Okay. Right.
Although they're allowed to credit that cost back against their payments to us.
Oh, really?
I
would include that as part of your analysis. That was an important point.
Yeah.
Who has jurisdiction over the upland pit that's associated with most of these river CCQs?
Nobody. There is a regulation that was passed about 12 or 14 years ago after the school bus down in the valley went into a pit that requires a berm if you're within a certain distance of a public road. But other than that, there's no regulations requiring restoration of the land or anything else.
We may want to look at some more audits. Apparently when we did an audit, it was
let's take them one at a time. Good question. All right. Good question. Any other questions? Are these permits issued or requested for anything other than excavation of sand and gravel?
No, sir.
The only purpose.
You mean for mining or?
Yeah, we're talking about just about mining permits. There's
like pipeline crossings or other intakes, outfalls. Just clearing out areas that have been buried, where the stream bed's been buried by a flood. We've seen a lot of those the last few years in the hill country, where the whole landscape has wound up in the riverbed or the Guadalupe or the Nueces or the Frio, and so traditional swimming holes.
That's a good point. We do get a lot of those, where someone has said there's been a dam in place there for 50 years, and it comes a big rain and it just let us out with gravel, and they want to reestablish their swimming hole,
Oh, you're supposed to get a permit?
Let's go through this. Commissioner Parker's got a couple of one.
Commissioner Parker, you lost control of him. He's fired. Take note, Dan. He lost control
of him. Like if a pipeline installer is going across private land, but he comes to a creek that is 30 feet wide or in excess of 30 feet wide there, then does he have to get a permit to excavate that creek? Yes, sir. And sometimes they avoid that necessity by either drilling underneath and never going through the creek bed or putting it over. But if he does lay it in the creek bed, yes, and disturb the bed, then that's a permitting activity under
what sort of a investigating action do you have on do pipeliners normally come to you and say, hey, I've got to get, fix me a permit, I'm going to cross Charlie Creek down there. But how many of them do you reckon do not come to you and just go ahead and start putting their pipeline in?
I sure don't know how many don't comply. We certainly, I think the quality companies and consultants out there are do their homework and they know that they have to do this.
Any sort of investigative process to determine whether or not those guys are taking advantage of something out in the East Texas piney woods? Nobody's going to see this pipeline going through, and they go ahead, because there are a lot of pipelines going in East Texas right now because of the resurgence of the gas exploration.
We've been getting a lot of calls over the last, I'd say increasingly over the last 3 to 5 years, relative to that. We check them frequently, just send them to the general land office to find out whether the general land office feels that that is a qualified stream, a navigable stream. And a lot of times they come back and say, yes, we need a permit to cross this creek and that creek and that creek. Pipelines are often not a big problem with crossings because we have a common interest. They don't want their pipeline to be eroded out and exposed, and we're looking for stable bed and banks. And so our interest is frequently common there in restoring the stream bed to the best possible condition with pipelines. They're actually less of a problem than a lot of other kinds of projects. But we are getting a lot of calls,
getting a lot of calls up in East Texas. You know, private landowner, hey, this guy's out here telling me he's going to put a pipeline across my property, and it's going to be going across creeks. And I can only call 3894802
in Austin. The law enforcement division, the game wardens, are our enforcement arm for detecting issues out there, complaints and that sort of thing, and taking the first look at what might be a permitted activity or a violation.
Commissioner Holmes,
the pipelines typically go under the navigable streams, or do they just go across?
The larger streams in the last, again, increasingly over the last 15, 20 years, they have preferred to bore under when they could, because it puts their pipeline down into good hard substrate where they don't have to worry about the banks. And just making that cut in the bank often destabilizes it enough to, no matter what they do, it will start to eat into it. And so a lot of pipelines on the Brazos and lower Colorado in the 80s and 90s had to go in with massive projects to try to stabilize the banks of those unstable rivers to keep their pipelines from being exposed.
But when they do go under, is there any either rule or rule of thumb as to how far under the bottom of the bed?
We don't have one. I mean, it's usually based on geotechnical considerations. They want to get down into a hard, durable substrate, and I would say that most of those are going 10 or 15 feet below the bed of the stream, just so that they never have to worry about that river eating in their pipe.
Right. What is our history of approvals versus denials?
I can't recall denial in my time at agency of an individual permit application. We have declined to issue, I would say, something less than 10% of the general permit applications that we've received.
I was going to say, some of those in the Hill Country where somebody wanted to take a rock saw or jackhammers or something and hammer into the rock stream bed. For instance, that one that popped up in Blanco County, where there was actually a local prohibition against doing anything like that. Most of the ones that we might deny at some point wind up with the applicant pulling out because of local opposition or because of staff concerns. As I say, well, it's going to be some kind of ecological issue, I just won't do it.
What percentage would you say of the applicants?
Pretty small. Less than 5%, maybe.
When there's a denial, do we publish the rationale for denial? How do we communicate that?
I think Roland is correct that if it reaches that point, that the point of actual formal denial after a hearing process, but I think I can't recall any that have actually, and it is required in the rules that if we deny it, we have to voice our reasons. But typically, we've encountered more of the situation where folks understand what's going to happen, so they decide to cease pursuing it.
From the date of application, do we have any policy regarding the timeliness of our response to an applicant?
The general permit is interesting because if we don't do anything in 30 days, they're good to go. It's one of the few permitting programs. That's right. So we have to act within 30 days. The individual permit is not like that. It requires, and there's fairly extensive notice required, including mailed notice. So that there is no outside limit as to how long that can take.
Remember, we have the right to close. The staff has the right to move to an individual permit if they deem it appropriate.
That's right. Or, of course, as occasionally happens in a general permit, someone requests a contested case hearing. That's going to take it off that 30-day track, but it is a it is an expedited, streamlined process.
Yeah, I don't know how the other commissioners feel. I'd like to have some kind of policy related to time and response. I think people are entitled to that in a regulatory matter. I understand those can be very complex. It may not be simple, but it sort of puts an applicant with a contentious case in a limbo, potentially.
Once the contested case request is made, we are in the position of referring it to the State Office of Administrative Hearings, and the scheduling and the fate of that, the timing of that is really out of our hands. If a contested case here is requested, we no longer have the ability to say, oh, this has to happen by such and such.
How does that work? Do we still have an involvement at that point?
We are a participant in that hearing. We
no longer control the agenda.
Right. It has to go through that. It becomes a matter governed by the Administrative Procedure Act at that point. If a contested case hearing
deals with the timing, to understand.
Right. They're going to control when the hearing occurs and how long for discovery and all those kinds of things.
And last question: how do we handle the concept of consequentiality with respect to the evaluations we make, the consequential impact of certain things versus the other, perhaps more technical grounds, when we make a denial or an approval? How do we evaluate consequentiality with the ecological impact, the resource impact?
I'm not entirely sure I understand. We're looking at the ecological sustainability of the system, and we would look at situations such as, is it going to cause local or downstream erosion? Could it stimulate head cutting in the stream bed? We really want these to be more in the line of restoring the system, especially on these smaller ones. The larger ones, the major study that was done by the Bureau of Economic Geology and the U.S. Geological Survey was aimed at determining both local erosional and depositional impacts as well as the sediment budget to the coast. And that lengthy study determined that those commercial operations, as they've been practiced on the Lower Brazos, did not have an effect unless it was actually ameliorative, that at least in the short term, it reduced the erosion against the opposite bank by pulling back the point bar.
So is it our policy that there's a consequential impact on the system as opposed to on the immediate location?
Both.
And how do we weigh the two?
We're looking for no significant impact. I mean, the statute actually requires the Department of Commission to find that there be no significant impact on fishing habit, waters, rivers, channels, creeks, bars, islands, navigability, any of those factors. And so we're looking for as close to zero as possible, and certainly not anything that we would tolerate that would be a significant impact in the stream or on adjacent properties.
How do we generally define significant? I guess I'm trying to understand.
That's that beautiful word that's used in all the environmental regulations. We would hope that it would be something that would be self-restoring. For instance, when you have these operations on the Lower Brazos, it's a major example that the river is capable, if they stop work tomorrow, the river is capable in the next two or three flood events of recreating their situation as it was before they started.
So it might have a temporary impact, but it's right. Really mitigated natural.
In fact, they're redredging bars now that have been dredged out four or five times in the last 20, 25 years.
Anybody else have any questions? Thank you all very much. Okay, item number three, land sale, Briscoe County, Caprock Canyon's Trailway, Pleasant Coulee. Presentation.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Corky Colvin with the Land Conservation Program. This is a land sale in Caprock Canyon's Trailway. It's a trailway, as you all know, about 64 miles in the Panhandle of Texas. This particular item is in Briscoe County, actually in the city limits of Kittaquay. Due to a mutual misunderstanding between park staff and adjacent landowner, that the landowner built part of his house on the trailway. The area we propose to sell is a 50-foot wide section. The trail is 200 foot wide in that area, so to leave us 150 foot of trail. The price that was arrived at was there were no comparable sales in the area. I couldn't, people are letting their lots go for back taxes, much less financial sales. So I went to the tax appraisal, added 50% to the tax appraisal, and came up with a $680. So you can see the little strip. The magenta section is adjacent landowner, and the little red polygon is what we plan on selling, with the green being the trailway.
Just any questions? We've seen this before.
Yeah.
Okay. If there's no further questions, we'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 4, land donation, Bastrop County, Bastrop State Park, also called the Pool.
Again, for the record, Corky Coleman. This is a land donation at Bastrop County, Bastrop State Park. It's 265 acres. The red polygon to the north is the 265 acres. It has some highway frontage on 21. It has over a mile in common with the state park. This donation will require no extra help or cost to the state park. It will be managed by the state park with existing personnel. And the only terms and conditions would be to accept the donation of 265 acres. This is the motion to be tomorrow.
Any questions? Okay. For no further discussion by the commission, I'll post this item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number 5, nomination for oil and gas lease, Corky Coleman.
The authority for leasing their mineral rights on parcel of life and lies at board of lease at the GLO. The board of lease has traditionally honored the recommendations of this commission. We have 4 nominations this time: Cottle County, Harrison County, Somerville, Cameron, Kettle Lake State Park. The whole park has been nominated. Down the Shore Valley, 1,387 acres being the whole park has been nominated. Matador Wildlife Management Area, a 200 acre tract out of the whole has been nominated. And Resaca de la Palma, 160 acres. How the whole has been nominated. I'd like to say I've had some public comment for the first time about the nominations that at Cattle Lake and Dinosaur Valley. I had quite a few people email me at voicing concern over having drilling in Dinosaur Valley State Park. When I responded to them that it was no surface occupancy and there would be no drilling in Dinosaur Valley, they were okay with it. There's one gentleman at Cattle Lake that brought up a good point. Even though Cattle Lake is a small park, and even though we recommend no surface occupancy, it doesn't stop somebody from leasing a 5-acre tract adjacent to the, and then putting a drilling rig right on the fence line. And so you might have a trail or a campground here, and then right across the fence, 100 feet away, having a drilling rig.
For
25 days.
Yeah. Well, you might use stop it because them leasing the park would give them sufficient acreage to do pooling or drilling on their lease, make the people to do.
Well, the way you stop it is not okay, not right.
But the other, we don't want to do that. The other option is no lease and let them bring our gas.
That's right.
The alternative is drainage, and that's drainage. Not a good alternative.
Yes.
And
then you said it's the recommended terms and conditions, no surface occupancy, the $150 minimum rate, 25% royalty, 10 acres value rental, and a 3-year lease.
And where's the income go?
The income from the, if it's a state park, it goes to Fund 64, goes straight to state park, and if it's a WMA, it goes up to 09, directly to the wildlife fund.
And where do these numbers come from? Are they up?
This number actually is just, if you figure the acreage up for lease, the $150 minimum. And you'll hear a little bit from Ann in a minute about it, maybe something we hope to do. And actually, in a case like this, the lease period, or the nomination period, the bid period is ended for all of these sites. And I will go to a meeting on Monday at the GLO to recommend that they do accept or not accept the bid that they've got.
Yeah, so this is what you're calling them?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so it could be much higher, for that matter.
In this case, they were a lot higher.
Yeah, I thought they would be. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Pretty rough. Any further questions for Courtney? Okay. No discussion. Okay.
Get the money.
I'll place this, if no further questions. Place this item on Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Now we've got item number 6, Commission Policy, Delegation of Authority, Executive Director of Oil and Gas Lease Nominations with No Service Occupancy, Ann Bright.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. And I wanted to talk to you about something that if the Commission is okay with this, we'll present it to you tomorrow for adoption. Then it's actually a policy change, not a rule change. As Courtney just went over, the Board for Lease for Parks and Wildlife Lands, which is actually administered through the General Land Office, they're authorized to lease our property for mineral exploration and production. And they've traditionally honored the Commission recommendations. As the previous discussion demonstrated, these minerals can provide an important source of revenue for Parks and Wildlife, especially on our state parks. At the same time, preserving the natural resource value of our parks is critical to our mission. As a result, we usually request off-site drilling. The Board for Lease meets 4 or less times a year, and their meetings don't always coordinate with the Commission's meetings. So one of the things we'd like for you to consider is a policy to delegate to the Executive Director the authority to approve these nominations when there are two conditions that are met. One is there's no surface occupancy. Secondly is when the royalty and any payments are at least what's consistent in the industry. And this would be the policy. The reason for this is really just pure revenue. This summer, I think you probably all realized that the oil prices went up significantly. And so if you can act in a way that is coordinated with the commission, the Board for Lease meeting, then there's always a possibility that these can occur more quickly. And then this would be the recommended resolution and the recommended motion. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And then also, I should say, Corky Coleman and Ted Hollingsworth, who actually deal with the GLO, are here. And they can probably talk a little bit more about that actual process.
Could we add to that that the executive director would report on
that? Absolutely.
So the commission's aware of what actions were.
Absolutely.
Commissioner Parker, you have a question.
Who is the first in lease?
You know, it's made up of, I think, the commissioner of the General Land Office. There's a representative from Parks and Wildlife, I believe, that is on the Board for Lease. And I'm not sure who all else is on there.
Who is our rep?
Who would be a rep?
I usually designate our land conservation like Jack Bauer or Corky as our representative.
And there are actually several boards for lease. There's one for the Department of Corrections. There's one for university lands. And this one just deals with Parks and Wildlife. And I think they all have a similar composition.
I'm trying to find here the resolution. Here it is. And could you put up the resolution for a minute?
It's on here right there.
The only issue that I had at the end of the second paragraph, it says, and that the payments to TPW are consistent with or higher than payments customary in the industry. And I will only point this out that the industry statewide, in other words, the industry standard for the state may be X number of dollars bonus, while this particular area we're releasing may be totally different. So
we change that to the area?
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between the Trans-Pecos and the Barnett Shale, yeah. $350 and $10,000.
Yeah. There market conditions in the area.
In the area.
That's what I was going to suggest. In the area as compared to the industry, because the industry is widespread, and the area may be not consistent with the industry.
Yeah. And that's lessor's interest, not the industry. The industry
would pay you a lot less than the lessor's
interest. We're counting on some of your expertise in this area, so we appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah. When these nominations go to the General Land Office, they are in tune with what
is going on in the specific area. And they know what it's been leasing for. And when it says $150 minimum as an industry standard, when they look at Dinosaur Valley, they check that figure way up as a minimum bid. It doesn't say it's $150 for Dinosaur Valley. It goes up to where the minimum bid of what's going on in the area.
But we will make this change because I do think that's a more accurate.
Yeah, not hurt. I think it would clarify it.
Absolutely.
Mr. Patterson or Commissioner Patterson is real good about sitting on his hands.
Yeah.
I would hate it, but it might put Bob in a position where, you know, the industry standard is 350 and the area standard is 150.
And that's a really good change, and we'll make that before the presentation tomorrow. Also, the ultimate decision in all of these matters is really with the Board for Lease. I mean, the role here is to make recommendations, and like I said before, that they are very good about honoring our recommendations, and especially with the no-service occupancy.
Okay, if there's no further discussion, I'll place the item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action.
Okay, so we're going to recess. And again, we'll have Commissioner Parker for infrastructure. We'll re-adjourn later for executive session.